CNN Radio, I'm Matt Cherry. It'll play host to presidential caucuses in a few weeks, and last night Iowa was the scene of the latest GOP debate. Mitt Romney targeted frontrunner Newt Gingrich in the debate on ABC, explaining the difference between the two men as he sees it.
We have differences of viewpoint on some issues, but the real difference, I believe, is our backgrounds. I spent my life in the private sector. I understand how the economy works.
While Gingrich shot back that Romney was only in the private sector because he lost a U.S. Senate race. When it comes to fixing the economy, President Obama insists he didn't underestimate how tough a job he faced.
I always believed that this was a long-term project.
The president's interview on CBS's 60 Minutes airs tonight. Many anti-government protesters in Syria are trying to get into neighboring countries after fearing for their lives and the lives of their family members. CNN's Jim Clancy is in Lebanon near its border with Syria, and he's been talking with many of the refugees who made it across.
They have come to this village among many others. This is called Al Rama. We are right on the Syrian border, just a short distance away behind me. And they have come here because many of them fear for the lives of their children. There's about 18 families in a school where I am. Of course, right now we are the center of attention in this small village.
Opposition sources say at least 9 people have been killed in violence in Syria today. A Pakistani Taliban commander claims a faction of the militant group is holding peace talks with the government. Pakistan's prime minister would not confirm the discussions, only saying they were open to them. Baseball's Milwaukee Brewers could be without slugger Ryan Braun for a while. The National League Most Valuable Player faces a possible 50-game suspension after testing positive for synthetic testosterone. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
Our new living room looks great. New sofa, entertainment center. Thanks to our personal loan from One Main Financial.
Mom, Dad, you're early.
Oh, I couldn't wait to see how you fixed up your new place.
Nice furniture.
You have a dream. We can help make it a reality. We are One Main Financial, providing personalized loan solutions with a simple, straightforward approach. Go to OneMainFinancial.com or call 1-855-321-MAIN. One Main Financial. Your needs, your goals, your dreams. Offer subject to restrictions and requirements of a licensee. For licensing information, visit our website or call us.
Happy holidays. Welcome to REI. Can I help you?
Long list of people to shop for. First, I need
a Patagonia down sweater.
Perfect. And then a pair of
Sorel Joan of Arctic women's boots.
Love it. And also a
REI Traverse 30 pack.
Well, that takes care of me. Now on to my list.
We know what you need and have all the outdoor gifts they'll love. With expert help in-store and online, we offer 100% guaranteed satisfaction with every gift you buy. Visit your local REI or REI.com. REI. Find out.
Hi, this is Carl Alsner of the Washington Capitals.
The green light for the linesman. Adam into the Washington zone. Coming down low, the shot, save made, that's it. Good morning, good afternoon, and good night, Buffalo. The Capitals with a win in the shootout, 4-3 over the Sabres.
Catch every minute of Caps hockey right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com.
Hey, everybody, this is David Nellis and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. Join us next Sunday, December 11th, when we're going to have the folks in from Marenko Ice Cream. We've got the Master Shucker from Watershed. That's the new restaurant from Todd and Ellen Gray. And Mr. Rain will be in here. Oh, yes, Mr. Rain. That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live right here on 1500 and 820 AM.
There is a watchmaking standard that is revered around the world. That standard comes from Rolex. From clasp to bracelet to its unique watertight oyster case, a Rolex holds its value because it was intended to. Crafted from just 3 precious metals, platinum, steel, and gold, each defies the ordinary. Its steel, 904L, virtually indestructible and corrosion resistant, is incomparable. Its patented Everrose Gold, created in an exclusive foundry, will remain beautiful for life. Inside, a genuine Rolex movement is a product of superiority and remarkable testing. It is unrivaled. At Rolex, flawless standards create more than a watch. They create a value that was meant to endure. For a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Phil Horeggi of the company Saber Systems. And the three of us are thrilled to introduce to you four fabulous guests. Bob Fox. Bob is the founding principal of Fox Architects and the publisher of Workspace Design Magazine. Also on the show, Rich Goober. Rich is the chief financial officer and executive vice president of Embrace Home Loans. Vicki Worker. Vicki is the chair of the Corporate Board Committee of Women in Technology and the leader of Leadership Foundry. And lastly, Dr. Dick Hayes, founder and president of Evidence-Based Research. Let's get started. We'd like to introduce you to our first guest, Bob Fox. Bob, again, is the founding principal of Fox Architects and the publisher of Workspace Design Magazine. Welcome, Bob.
And Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Well, what is Fox Architects?
Fox Architects is a 65-person architectural and interior design and workplace firm. We have two offices located in Washington, D.C. and Tyson's Corner. And our core business is really dealing with commercial office space and, you know, companies that are looking to create very positive work environments. You know, we aspire to work with those companies that want to be great places to work.
You said something about the cloud really changing the way people think about office space. Tell us about that.
We're at a very exciting time right now. The whole concept of how people work is evolving very rapidly. And, you know, what we're seeing is technology having a huge impact on the way that people work. The cloud's probably one of the biggest things that impacts that today. People can work anywhere they want, anytime they want, on anything that they want, and access it, you know, really just through an internet connection.
So your firm is specialists in helping people figure out how the cloud impacts favorably the way they work.
Well, our firm is really focused on the physical work environment. You know, what does it take to, for people to get their work done and how they can collaborate together?
Tell us a little bit about Workspace Design Magazine.
That's a magazine I started a year ago. It really evolved from a whole bunch of interns who were calling me and saying, hey, Bob, I'd like to work for the firm. You know, we were not very busy. It was sort of in the throes of the recession. You know, so we really didn't have anything to offer them. And I felt bad. And I said, hey, you know, let's get together and we'll talk. And really out of that became a group discussion. And I thought, you know, newsletter. And that's really where the magazine evolved from.
Yeah. Well, what did your dad have to do with you being an architect?
Well, my dad was an architect, and he worked for Lou Kahn and Mitchell Jurgala, which were two very prominent architects. And so I think as a way for me to really spend more time with my dad, I, you know, sort of migrated into architecture.
Tell us a little bit more about your dad.
He was a great guy, very talented architect, some great designs. You know, I hung out in his office as a kid. You know, he took me into his office on the weekends, and I'd spend time, you know, with the I think I'm lucky I have on my fingers. You know, I'd spend time in the wood shop where they made these great models, and I was playing with all the tools and equipment, you know, just cutting things up. So,
in the green room, you described your dad as brilliant. How could you tell? And how young were you when you could tell, wow, my dad's brilliant at this?
Oh, I was always struggling with some problem to solve, and he'd always come up with some, you know, incredibly brilliant or creative solution for it. So,
now, you actually would give your father some feedback from time to time. In fact, you said you were his greatest critic. What does that mean?
Well, I think I didn't really understand my dad's business when I was young. And I think, you know, we weren't, I would say, a very well-off family when I was young. And, you know, so as a result, you know, I think I was seeing my friends who always had better toys than I did. And I think I was saying, Dad, you know, look, you really need to focus on doing a better job with your business. So.
You raise a good point because architects are brilliant, hardworking people. But it's a very tough business that has seen a lot of volatility. You've got a good-sized firm. How do you lead people and maintain that loyalty among your people?
Well, I feel fortunate that our firm is one that I would say is very well balanced when it comes to understanding the business aspect and managing it, along with the creative side. You know, we're really specialists in, you know, the workplace, and we help businesses to solve creative problems, and we develop great spaces. I think one of the things I'm most proud of is last year we won the IIDA award for the Pinnacle Award for one of our projects, which is the highest recognition our peers can bestow.
Congratulations.
Bob, you had mentioned that the magazine itself started as a result of working with some of these interns that were interested in working for the firm. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that got its start with the work of the interns?
Yeah, like I said, I had a group of interns who were calling me saying, hey, Bob, I'd like to work in your firm and get that experience. And, you know, usually we have a number of interns in the office every summer because it's something that I feel very strongly about and obligated to help the younger people in the profession. But unfortunately, in 2008, it was a tough year, and that kind of extended into, you know, the last 2 years. So it was really last year I sort of felt bad, and I thought, well, I really should get, you know, a number of these people together and have a group discussion. And so we focused on the workplace and the future office, and, you know, that was really where a lot of the ideas came from.
Now, you had mentioned, you know, that you found it was important to be a mentor type of figure. Is there an experience that you have of having maybe been mentored that contributed to this?
Well, I think I'm going to go way back to my bike racing days. You know, back in the, you know, going to say early 70s, you know, I had a guy really take me under his wing and, you know, coach me and spend time with me. And you know, I was planning to ride my bike just touring, but he got me into racing. I really learned. I won the first race that I was in, and I really learned from that. And a lot of the hard work, the diligence, the effort, you know, that has to go into it, I think really served as a foundation for, you know, my leadership and, you know, just working hard to grow a business.
You talked about riding through Amish country en route to winning the Pennsylvania State Championship. Tell us a story about that.
It was a 60-mile race, and I'm out there with, you know, all the guys on our, you know, probably back then $1,000 bicycles, what today might be a $4,000 or $5,000 bicycle. But, you know, we were racing on some of these very hilly, very steep courses, and, you know, there was a group of guys who were out there, you know, in Amish country with their wool trousers on, their suspenders, no shirts, very tanned bodies, and the biggest, heaviest bikes you can imagine. So, and they had no problem at all keeping up with us.
Wow. You've got 50 people, roughly. How do you keep them from making your office a continual laboratory for new ideas?
We actually try to promote that as part of it, because I think that, you know, we're always looking for new ideas and trying to solve problems creatively for our clients. But I think trying to contain that and manage that so that we have, you know, I guess a product that we can show to our clients and that we're productive with that work is a constant challenge.
Yes, Bob, you had mentioned, you know, these interns looking for jobs. Is there something unique about, you know, the workspace and the work type of culture that you have that makes you a desirable place to work?
Well, our office is a completely open environment. We have no private offices. You know, a lot of it, I think, has to do with the work that we do. You know, there's a lot of people that are critical to a successful project and putting it together. We need people who are aware of codes, who are aware of, you know, furniture finishes, who are aware of light fixtures, who understand all the technology that goes into buildings. So there's a lot of communication, you know, that occurs. And so as a result of that, you know, we have a very open work environment that people can access and learn very quickly who the experts are, you know, to take advantage of that knowledge.
You mentioned that the office may be a thing of the past in the next decade, at least in some industries. That's so revolutionary. How do you propose to lead clients into that space?
I don't think it'll be a thing of the past. I think that there will continue to be a place that people go. It'll be there, I think, as much for the social interaction as well as the collaboration. But the way that people work, the 150-square-foot office is a dinosaur. I mean, you know, we think of offices as it being my office, but that office is only occupied 40% of the time. So as a result, people are saying, hey, that's very expensive real estate, and, you know, they're looking for more efficient and effective ways to utilize that space.
Well, let's go back in time. Obviously, you're a very, very successful business owner, architect today. Does that mean you were just an absolute superstar student right from the beginning in college?
I don't know that I'd say I was a superstar, but I had a lot of fun. I spent a lot of time in the pool hall shooting pool, and you know, there was one project I can remember where I was so frustrated. It was the end of the year. I was tired. I didn't want to do it. And then I just had an idea come to me, and I spent probably 2 hours drawing this solution and putting the board together. And it was a design competition. I wound up winning the competition. And there were, you know, my peers who had spent 2 and 3 days, you know, designing and rendering this thing who were, like, very frustrated with the fact that I had won. But
so why would that not have taught you that you can just fly by the seat of your pants and still get by?
Well, I think it takes a lot of thought. I mean, while I had only spent a couple of hours, drawing it, I had really spent a lot of time thinking about it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of ideas, and how to organize those ideas in a way that can really effectively solve a problem, I think, does require a lot of vigor, rigor, and, you know, putting the project together.
You had mentioned that in college you transitioned from spending a lot of time at the pool hall smoking cigarettes, which didn't help your biking career, by the way, to really changing and getting serious. Did that have anything to do with some advice you got from a stockbroker when you were 21?
Well, my cousin was a stockbroker, and I had asked him a question one day. I said, "Who are your clients? Who are the people that invest the money with you?" And he had basically said that it was the business owners, and I think that was a big inspiration for me. But I think there was a point there in my second year of college where I realized I really needed to focus on it, my career, and be diligent about the path that I took, and got much more focused.
During your biking career, I know that in training, that can be a very solitary type of experience. Do you find today that you have a need or a desire to find solitude as a way to maybe gather your thoughts?
That's a great point, and I really do feel like there are those moments that you have to get that solitude, to step back from the world, from the fast pace, and really, have that quiet time.
In just a few words, what does your dad, the architect, think about his son, the architect firm owner?
Well, I would hope he's very proud of me. I think, I've got a firm with, 60 people in it today in 2 offices, and, I think he enjoys that, and I think, he likes hearing the stories about, what we go through in our day-to-day operations.
Bob, would you give us the web address for both Fox Architects and Workspace Design Magazine?
Fox Architects is www.fox-architects.com, mm-hmm. and the magazine is at www.workspacedesignmagazine.com. Workspace design is all one word.
Perfect. We've been speaking with Bob Fox. Bob is the founding principal of Fox Architects and the publisher of Workspace Design Magazine. I'd like to thank my co-host for helping me with the interview, Ed Alera with Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Phil Horeggi with Sabre Systems. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Mark Slavin.
And Mark, who are you with?
I'm with Mark Park Incorporated.
But that's not what you're here to talk about today, is it?
Not today.
What are you here to talk about?
I'd like to talk about the XL Institute, which is near and dear to my heart. It's a nonprofit school in Washington, D.C.
And what does it do?
We teach inner-city kids that have had trouble to be auto mechanics, certified auto mechanics.
What sort of trouble?
Drugs, or just lost and not, dropped out of school, haven't been able to find their way.
How does someone get into this program?
Well, there's a pretty intensive interview process. We're advertising, we're promoting, and we're drawing these kids in, word of mouth, basically.
Yeah. How long does the program last?
2 years is the full course.
And when someone graduates, what are they then able to do?
Well, we're proud to say that we're putting these young people out there with degrees in auto mechanic, the capability of, for instance, working for a Volkswagen corporation or working for a Cadillac dealership.
Yeah. I'm guessing that they're getting a whole lot more out of this than just
life skills.
Such as?
We're teaching mathematics, reading skills, life skills, how to take care of your family.
Yeah. If someone wanted to learn more about this or wanted to help in some way, where would they go to find out more?
Right to our website, www.thexcelinstitute.com. And Cheryl Edwards heads that up for us. She's the CEO.
Perfect. We've been speaking with Mark Slavin of Mark Park and Excel Institute. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Ed Lara of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Phil Horegi of Saber Systems. And we are thrilled to introduce you to our next guest, a gentleman by the name of Rich Guber. Rich is the Chief Financial Officer and Executive Vice President of Embrace Home Loans. So, Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And tell us, what is Embrace Home Loans?
Embrace Home Loans is a residential mortgage banking company, and we operate in 46 states, and we have two platforms, one that is a direct-to-consumer model through direct mail, and the other is a retail mortgage banking brick-and-mortar operation.
What is one thing the average borrower, average person, might not realize about a mortgage lender?
Well, we are a mortgage banker versus a broker, so we take care of all of the facets of the mortgage lending process in-house versus parceling them out to different parties. And we have our own credit facilities allowing us to close loans with our own money and not use others.
And this is not your first business venture, is that right?
I've been involved with other business ventures in the real estate development world prior to mortgage banking.
Yeah. And your company was acquired by Embrace in 2009?
Yes, right? In December 2009 we were acquired.
And what was that like? Big celebration, party time? What was that like?
There was a lot of heavy lifting given the credit crisis that was occurring at the time and the financial environment. It was a very stressful time, yet it was a real victory once we got the deal done. And as it's turned out, you know, very nicely for everyone.
When did you first realize, I want to start my own business?
I had been working with a group called the Magruder Companies, where I sort of grew up my career. I started there very soon after college. And I had seen the owner, Hal Magruder, who had started this business. And it really interested me after being with him for 10, 11 years that we'd like to start something on our own. And he became one of our partners. And there were some other people mixed in from the area, some other associates. And it was just a great feeling of independence and pride involved with starting our own business.
Tell us about the independence. We hear business owners say, I want to be my own boss. But, of course, the customer or client is always the boss. What does independence feel like to you as a business owner?
Independence feels like being able to execute on your creativity, on your decisions, and really put them into to work in your company and get people to buy into it, too, those that surround you, your key employees and others, to buy into it.
Can you talk a little bit about the acquisition process? I know that that can be a very unsettling time for employees. And can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the things that you tried to do to try to soften the landing as much as possible?
Yes. The due diligence process was quite exhaustive. Given an acquisition during this time in financial history, needless to say, there was a lot of vetting that had to occur by the acquirer, making sure that everything made sense for them, given the landscape at the time. So that took months to get that done. It was basically going up like into the attic of your house and identifying every piece of lint. So you can appreciate that it was a very exhaustive process. Once we finished that and announced it to our employees, that was yet another challenge in that we had to assure people that we were going to be acquired by a quality company that was very experienced and that their lives were going to improve in many ways and that it had a much more robust technology platform, better marketing, and a more substantial company to weather the storm in the financial industry.
You've suffered through several ups and downs in the decades that this company's been in existence. How have you attracted people and kept people in this arena?
I believe we've done it by really people put their trust in our hands, and we had business. We were involved in the business community before that. A lot of our employees knew us through one shape or form, through family or through friends or other business associates. And we had been known as a trustworthy group in the real estate development business, and we transferred that over to the mortgage business. And I think that what takes to get things done is have people believe in you and lead through, you know, example.
You mentioned in the green room that one of the darkest hours, if you will, was managing through this incredible economic crisis that we've been through.
tell us more about that. Yeah, it was a very, very unsettling time in 2008, and just with banks going down and Wall Street firms going down and our source of funding drying up. I mean, the warehouse capacity was probably around 10% of what it had been out there. It was reduced by 90%, so the participants were very few and limited.
For those people who don't know that terminology, what do you mean by warehouse capacity, et cetera? What does that mean?
A warehouse lender is a specialized credit facility used by mortgage lenders. It's a short-term loan. It's a revolving credit facility, so you borrow and you pay back. You borrow and you pay back. So when someone is buying a house or someone is refinancing their loan, we are supplying that cash, essentially, to the closing attorney through a credit facility.
And the challenge you were facing in that situation was what?
Was that the banks supplying us with our money were going out of business. Day in and day out, and their source of funding was drying up too, which could they were a sort of a subsidiary of a bank, and the bank's capital was drying up. They weren't able to supply the necessary capital to the people we were receiving it from, and there was just a scarcity out there in the marketplace.
So how did that feel? And I'm really asking, how did it feel?
It was very, very scary. I mean, to put it frankly, in that day-to-day, you could not get the assurances from people you had dealt with for years that they were going to be there tomorrow. You had things literally drying up overnight, and it just took constant calls, meetings, lunches, dinners, whatever it took to maintain a tight bond with the people we did business with.
So going through this this crisis to make good on your promises, and to sort of like shepherd a change through this acquisition, it really required a steely resolve. Is that something that you knew that you had, or did you find out that you had, and where do you think it came from?
I think that I knew I had it, but until it was really put to the test, I truly went home one night and I looked in the mirror at myself, and it was exhausting, and all my partners and I and our employees, we were just, it was exhausting. I just said, we are going to get this done somehow, and we put everyone to work in the company, making phone calls, calling new lenders, and really our CFO at the time and others. It was a full-time job, just speaking to new banks, local, throughout the country, and finding new sources of warehouse financing, the credit facilities we needed.
You mentioned coming home a moment ago. Coming home to your children actually helped you through this crisis, did it not?
Yes, it did. I found that it was very refreshing after having sort of these days that were just so draining, and you just had nothing left at the end of the day, to just have your daughter sit in your lap and tell you about what went on during their day. And it sort of just put life into perspective, in that it was you realize there's more to it than what goes on during the day. You still had to have a family life during these times.
Tell us about losing your dad when you were 17 years old.
Yeah, my dad passed away 2 weeks prior to me going to college in 1979, and It was hard. I mean, we were close. I had not seen him a lot growing up, as he traveled a lot and went to work very early and came home very late. But we had a really special relationship, and I got to see through hard work. He was a music industry executive, and I got to see him sort of rise through the ranks, and I knew that it was through a lot of hard work and persistence that it paid off for him.
You had mentioned about coming home at the end of a grueling day, many grueling days, to the family, and I guess most fathers feel that they need to sort of like protect their kids from the battle scars during the workday. Is there a special challenge in that, to try to make that sort of like transparent to the family?
Yeah, they understood. I explained to them. My daughters were younger at the time, but my sons. But they, I think, understood that it was a very tough time in business. And I tried to explain to them what I did and how I was doing it. And I think that I saved all the newspapers from those days, so that when they're all older, I can explain to them better, from the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, what exactly was going on, so they could better appreciate it.
Where do you want to take this company now that you've been basically reborn, if you will, and we're still not out of the woods in the real estate industry, but what's your goal and to lead your people?
Well, we are trying to really drill down. Our industry is continuing to go through a lot of changes right now. The mortgage industry, there's Dodd-Frank regulation There's just a lot of changes that are going on. We are a non-bank lender, so we play by a little bit different set of rules than the big national banks do. And it's actually a much tougher going because there's things that we do that the big banks don't have to. But we're trying to really bear down, and as the CFO, very conscious about our costs, our spending, and just trying to make sure that we batten down the hatches and protect our capital for the future so we can continue to grow.
You know, I think about the movie It's a Wonderful Life and the Bailey Building and Loan. Is there something deeper here in you helping people change their lives, or is it just a business opportunity?
No, it really is. I mean, we are in a business that really we get to sometimes we joke and we call it the happiness business because we're providing money to people that are buying a house, buying their dream house. And, you know, in today's world, it's still very hard to get a loan. It's a very selective process. So when you're able to deliver that approval to a first-time home buyer, it's very meaningful. And there's a sort of a lifelong relationship that we have with our borrowers from that reason.
Would you please give us the web address for Embrace Home Loans?
Yes, it's embracehomeloans.com.
Would you spell that for us? I don't want anyone to miss it.
EMBRACE HomeLoans.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Rich. We've been speaking with Rich Guber, CFO and Executive Vice President of Embrace Home Loans. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera of Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney, and Phil Horegi of Saber Systems for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Greg Windsor.
Greg, who are you with?
I'm with windphoto.com, and we're a severe weather website, and I'm also an author.
A severe weather website? What does that mean?
Yes, well, it's about tornadoes, hurricanes, and other severe weather events that I photograph and also write about.
And how what are you, one of these storm chasers?
Yes, I'm a storm chaser. I go out to the plains every year, and you know, chase storms from a safe distance most of the time.
Sometimes. But you're not here to talk about tornadoes.
No, I'm here to talk about my new book, which is called Weathering the Storms of Your Business.
And you say new book, that means you already have other books?
Right. One of my other books is called Life is Like a Weather Forecast.
Okay. So this new book is about business. What do you know about business?
I've started and ran three businesses so far and had all kinds of interesting situations that have happened over the years, including a few perfect storms.
So a perfect storm in business is what?
Well, it's a storm in which a lot of different things all come together seemingly at the same time in the worst possible way.
So there's analogies between severe weather and running a business through turbulent times?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, if you search the internet for economic and storm, there's 150 million results for the two words.
Together?
Yes, together.
Wow. So someone would walk away after reading your book with what?
Right. Well, hopefully it's about surviving and succeeding when our businesses run into very challenging times and fine-tuning your radar. Yeah. And, of course, for recovery.
If someone wanted to learn more and buy the book, what would they do?
Log on to windphoto.com.
www.windphoto.com.
One word, W-I-N-D-P-H-O-T-O.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Greg Windsor of a severe weather storm chaser and the book Weathering the Storms of Business. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Thank Solutions. You. That was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And the three of us are thrilled to introduce you to our next guest. Her name is Vicki Walker. Vicki is the chair of the Corporate Board Committee of Women in Technology and the leader of the Leadership Foundry. So welcome, Vicki, and tell us, what is Women in Technology?
Thank you, Mike. Women in Technology is a nonprofit professional organization of women in the D.C. area, and our mission is to advance women from the classroom to the boardroom.
And how big or how small, by whatever metric you want to use?
There are 1,000 members in Women in Technology, run the gamut from women early in their career to women quite senior in their career.
So if you could give us just one example of how a woman is advanced by being a part of this organization.
Well, the Leadership Foundry, which we launched in 2010, is exactly that example. That's the boardroom side of it. And what we do is select some very well-qualified women, help them get training, network them, and mentoring to land their first corporate board seat.
How long have you been a champion for women in their careers, women attaining board positions?
Probably all my life I've been a champion for women in their careers, and something that's a passion for me.
Yeah. You had said that you have always had a non-traditional job or role in your career.
Yeah, I think that's true.
What does that mean?
Well, I started out in college very deliberately selecting a major in civil engineering that was not really traditional for most women because I was good in science and math, and I wanted to go into something that most women didn't go into.
Where do you think that came from?
Probably from my dad. My dad was an engineer.
Tell us more.
He was an engineer. He was always really interested in gadgets and technology and building things.
At what age were you interested in those things?
Very early on. He was a carpenter, never went to college, but a self-taught engineer. And whenever he was building something at the house, which was most of the time, I was the one handing in the wrench.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. He remodeled our kitchen multiple times, whether my mother wanted it remodeled or not, mostly because there was an opportunity to buy the latest and greatest router, if that was going to be the case.
And your role in the remodeling project was what?
You know, get the best bit for the router and get to use the power tools.
Were you understood by your friends, especially your girlfriends? I'm assuming they didn't have the same interests.
Yes and no. I think, you know, I was always more interested in math and science than they were. I did some of the typical girl things, but I think I was always headed in the direction of math and science and technology.
Yeah. Well, one of the qualities that you mentioned about your dad was that he was, quote, unflappable.
Absolutely.
What does that mean? And give us an example.
He had ice water in his veins. Nothing perturbed him. And best example was he was a private pilot. We were in a four-passenger plane, which had a crystal out in the radio. So we were lost in the mountains of Pennsylvania running out of gas. And he force-landed the plane in a field of timothy hay. We ran out of gas and dropped the last 10 feet.
And what was that like? Were you nervous, or did you have complete confidence in your dad?
I had confidence, but I have to say it was right before Mother's Day. My brother and I had bought my mother a pair of earrings for Mother's Day. I was 9, he was 12, and he said, I think we should give them to her now.
Well, you're very talented as an engineer, very disciplined intellectual profession, and building things. But how did you get into the leadership and boardrooms? Because those are totally different concepts.
Well, I spent my career in technology companies, and I moved up through the ranks of leadership in technology companies. And as I was doing that, I often saw that there were fewer and fewer women at the table when I advanced in my career.
And you mentioned something about building strong teams.
Oh. Yes, absolutely. I really think that diversity in a team of every dimension you can think of, whether it's cultural diversity, gender diversity, or diversity of skill sets and background and experience, makes a team stronger.
So you noticed that there was this underrepresentation of women in corporate boards, but I guess what's curious to me is, where did the call for action come from? So many people can make that same observation, but not everybody is called to act. So where did that call from come?
So Women in Technology has been talking about this for quite some time, and I helped the group put together two events where we had a panel of women who were board members speaking, and we had over 200 women attend the event. So we knew there was interest. After those two events, at some point, we had talked about it long enough, and I went to the WIT board and said, if you ever want this to be more than Vicky Worker's hobby, we need to form a committee, make me the chair, and give me some money, and I will launch a program.
Do women see you as sort of the Nelson Mandela of women on boards?
God, I hope not. But I think what we've found with the Leadership Foundry is that typically women think that if you work hard, you will get noticed. And that is absolutely not the case in getting on a board. To get on a board, you've got to know the people who are on the board. And so it's about networking. It's a not you have to have the skills and the competency, but it's about networking. So we're helping them in the networking.
So why should women want to be on boards, and why should boards want to have women on their boards?
Well, I think women want to be on boards because, just like men, they want to be able to use their talents and skills. There's also great networking opportunities, and there's great opportunity to learn about what's going on in other companies from fellow board members that you can take back to your own company and your own business. And I think boards should want to have them because there are many, many studies that have shown companies that have one, two, and particularly three women on their boards perform better financially.
What got you to just keep driving after it? I mean, it's one of these things that, you know, my daughter is an engineer, but now she wants to be a mom with three kids. So how do you keep at it?
I think it's just partially in me. I have been told by many people that I am relentless, and I guess I am relentless. If it's something that I and other people think is important, then it is worth doing, and it's worth doing well in a quality way and finding out what works. And you find out what works by working hard and getting it done.
In addition to to your trailblazing, sort of characteristic, you had mentioned in the green room some experiences you've had with dealing with employees being displaced by acquisition. So there's a real compassionate side to you. So where does this balance? We know that the dad side is the cool as a cucumber, never see a sweat. So where does the compassion come from?
Well, I think the compassion comes from having been in those shoes. I've spent many years in large corporations where, the large corporation is swayed by a lot of things, not the least of which is the macro economy we're going through right now. And as a leader, I have had to lay people off. And it is it's very difficult to look across the table to someone who's worked hard, is competent, has done nothing wrong, and tell them you don't have a job for them.
Tell us about one time.
I remember very vividly that there was one gentleman that I had to let go, and I certainly didn't want to let him go. He was very good at what he did. He hadn't worked for us for too long, and we just were not making our numbers. We were a publicly traded company. We had to cut back on staff. And I sat down with him, and after I told him, he told me that his wife had just been laid off. So now the family has no income. And as it turned out, I later found out that they chose to relocate to where his wife's family was down in North Carolina. He had found a great job. He had been promoted, and it turned out to be a really great thing for the family, and he was kind enough to call me and let me know that, which was great. And I was very pleased for him because he was a terrific person that, deserved to have a great shot.
It seems like it all ended up well for him. How did it feel for you when you were actually giving him the notice?
Well, that's really difficult because it's different if it's a performance issue and someone really is not performing in a job. But when someone is performing in a job and you've got to deliver news that they're no longer going to be with the company, it has an impact. We're human beings. These are people that I get to know on a daily basis, get to like, and get to be invested in their success. So it's very difficult to tell someone you're invested in some bad news.
Yeah.
Well, the Metro D.C. area is very high tech. Do you think this area offers women more opportunity than, say, another Midwestern area which doesn't have as much technology for leadership positions?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I've got data on that, and as an engineer, I am kind of all about data. I think it varies by company. I think some companies are more willing to see different perspectives and have different leaders.
What does Dad think of his unflappable daughter?
Well, my dad unfortunately passed away a number of years ago, but he always was very supportive of anything I wanted to do. He was always very supportive if I wanted to go for something big, and he was always very supportive if I wanted to buy another router tool.
Vicki, would you please give us the web address for Women in Technology?
Sure. Women in Technology is womenintechnology.org, and the Leadership Foundry is theleadershipfoundry.com. Org.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Vicki Walker. Vicki is the chair of the Corporate Board Committee of Women in Technology and the leader of the Leadership Foundry. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Ed Alera of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Phil Horeggi of Saber Systems for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in just a moment after these important business spotlights. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is...
Lori Reed.
Lori, who are you with?
Executive Gift Planners.
What is Executive Gift Planners?
We take all the worry out of you obtaining a holiday gift or a birthday gift or a retirement gift, whatever you need. We take the worry out of that and supply it so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
What is the worry, or what are the worries?
Of like going out to the store to find it or purchasing something that's been in a warehouse for 6 months. We provide fresh, local products to your clients and represent you.
In fact, you said customized when we were talking earlier. What does that mean?
We customize all of our gift baskets. If you have promotional products or need to purchase promotional products, we can include those in the baskets for you, or we can make a basket specifically for if you have a special event coming up, or if you have clients that are coming into town and want just specifically Virginia products, we can do that for you.
Who is a good client or somebody who could use your service?
Just about anyone. We work with a lot of hotels. We work a lot with attorneys. We work a lot with any corporation that needs gifts, and we do a lot with, we also imprint the ribbon at no charge for our clients also.
Can you give us a success story?
I can. We had a client who called us last year for the holidays, and it was towards the end of December, and products were down to nothing, but we were able to pull it off for them. We used our local vendors, and we have a very family-oriented business, and they were able to get the products, and we got the baskets done and delivered for them the next day.
So if someone wants to order some gifts from you, how do they do that?
They can call us, or they can go to www.egpgifts.com.
We've been speaking with Lori Reed of Executive Gift Planners. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horeggi of Saber Systems and Ed Alera of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we are thrilled to introduce to you our final guest today, Dr. Dick Hayes. Dr. Dick Hayes is the founder and president of Evidence-Based Research. May we call you Dick?
Sure.
Welcome, Dick. Welcome to the show. Tell us, what is evidence-based research?
Small group of analysts who use quantitative techniques to study problems that are complex or complicated. For example, how do you forecast instability in the third world?
If you could give us that example and probably dumb it down for at least me, when you say instability in the third world, how do you solve or forecast that problem?
Well, there's two different approaches. One is statistical. You take the history and the statistics relevant to a variety of countries, and you have the facts about what instability they've experienced, mm-hmm. and you use the statistics to create a predictive model.
Okay.
The other is experts. We have some structures of questions, and if we get experts who can answer those questions properly, we'll get forecasts that take advantage of their experience, and that's better because it's much more recent. Statistics take time. People stay up to date.
So using that example, who would benefit from knowing whether a particular third world country was unstable or not?
There really are two classes of clients for that. One are institutions, part of the U.S. government or international organizations who are deciding where to operate and where to pay attention. The other are businesses who are making investment decisions. Where do I invest, or what's the risk if I continue to invest where I already am?
Are there particular problems that you find particularly interesting to solve?
Well, I'm inherently an analyst, so I'm more likely to warm up when I realize a problem is hard. That's a good example of a hard problem. Another one that I find fascinating is, given a business or an organization with a mission, if we can understand the market that it's operating in, the problems it has, what's the best way to organize that business? How should they flow information? How should they functionally organize? How do they allocate decision rights?
How big or small is evidence-based research?
We're about 25 folks.
And you are the founder. You founded the firm when?
1987.
This is an intriguing mix of science, mathematics, and policy. Were you trained as a mathematician, or how did you get into this?
I started in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, which is very soft, but you learn a lot of facts and history. And in graduate school, I went to Indiana University, where they were pioneering the quantitative study of political science. And so I got both ends of that training, and combined, they let you work on some very interesting problems.
So why start your own company?
I was very frustrated in the companies that I had worked in, because I thought they didn't understand how to run their companies for success. Success defined the way that I define it, which is to find interesting problems and interesting people to work with and for.
Yeah. In fact, when you were asked that question in the green room, you said, quote, "I can't stand how others ran their companies." What gave you the confidence to feel like you could do it better?
I've never lacked for self-confidence.
And that came from where?
It's hard to know. We all grow up, I suppose your success in school, success in life leads you to believe that you can undertake things if you treat them seriously.
But you made an adventuresome move when you were in high school. High school is always a difficult time for most kids. And you moved out of state basically on your own and went to a new school by yourself. How did you do that, and what brought that about?
No, I had no choice in the sense that the city of Norfolk had decided to close its high schools rather than integrate them. And so my choices were between finding a way to go to school and not. And my family had property in West Virginia that I could use as a base to register. And it turned out, fortuitously, they had an excellent high school.
Could you walk us through a few more of the details of what was going on? You said that the school closed rather than integrate. Give us a little more detail about that.
Now, what little I know is that there were 11 students, which a federal court had said needed to be admitted in what were the high school and junior high schools of the city. And this was during the struggle over civil rights, so it was by 1962, actually. And so it would have been my junior year. There were no schools open. The Navy, we thought, would open schools for its student population, but the federal government was determined not to take the pressure off the city. In fact, I saw a study a number of years later that said that less than a quarter of the people who were in my graduating class ever finished high school.
Wow. So here you are as a junior. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And there wasn't a lot of money in the family at the time.
That's correct. My father was a naval warrant.
So what did you do?
I got on a Greyhound bus. I went to Wheeling, West Virginia. I went to stay with a great uncle who put me up for a couple of weeks while I found an apartment, and I enrolled myself in high school.
Go ahead.
I was just so stunned by the fact that you enrolled yourself in an apartment at 16. I mean, this is amazing.
Well, it was what had to be done.
Now, your father was a career Navy, and then you also then went active duty and served in Vietnam. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Well, Vietnam is a life experience for anyone who served there. I went through the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and I was tired of going to school. I had an ROTC commission, so I decided I would go on active duty. That happened to be I graduated in June of 64, which meant that as a junior officer, I was quick on the rotation, and I wound up volunteering to go to Vietnam.
Now, you had mentioned your role there was as a forward observer. Now, that seems to have a lot of correlation directly to your current job.
Well,
analyst skill.
When you're a second lieutenant in the artillery, you're a forward observer when you arrive in theater.
So what does that mean? If you could give us an example, thinking back to you as a forward observer of Vietnam.
Forward observer moves with the infantry, and in the event of either a firefight or an opportunity to inflict casualties, you're the one who talks to the guns.
Why did they pick you, or why did you pick it? Yeah.
You may not know that whole story, but in the Army, if you are reasonably high IQ, they consider that the trigonometry, and at that time we did artillery by hand. We used slide rules and protractors, not computers. They wanted somebody who could understand it. From my point of view, I went to three. I was a distinguished military graduate. I went to three schools to choose my branch. In the armor, they told me that armor was invincible, and they would slaughter the infantry. At the infantry school, they blew up a tank to show me that armor was not invincible. The artillery types pointed out to me that they were their bases were several kilometers away from the fighting. They didn't mention second lieutenants as forward observers.
Well, that generation of officer generated a lot of iconoclasts. And has that carried over into your business career?
I'm not sure. I'd have to ask other people.
You had mentioned that one of the biggest decisions... Actually, I'm going to ask you a different question. Tell us about digging deep holes in Vietnam.
the story is a very simple one. I had a very nice, a very bright young buck sergeant, a three-striper, who we promoted to a gun chief. And one night we were in Rung Sot, which is a mangrove swamp, and the area was too hot. The helicopters wouldn't come in to lift out my two guns. So I waited till after dark, and then I moved the guns so that nobody would know where we were to mortar us or attack us. And when we do that, we have to dig in. So you had to dig trenches, dig the guns in. And I wandered around and made sure that everybody was safe. About a month later, a young buck sergeant who'd been out there with me running one of the guns checked out with me, and he said, "Sir, I'm going to go to college." And I'd encourage that. And I said, "Well, Jim, why are you going to do that?" And he said, "You remember that night in the Rung Sot?" And I said, "Yeah." And, well, I decided that night that instead of being the SOB, which was digging the holes, I was going to be the SOB next time, deciding when they were deep enough. And I consider that to be a success story.
Was that military experience, do you think that helped you build your company?
Absolutely.
How so?
First of all, a lot of what I write, and I've now co-authored 9 books for the military, is about military command and control. That is to say, command and control is military decision-making. Who gets what information? What do they do with it? What are the consequences? And so I developed the system for measuring that. I couldn't do that work if I hadn't lived it.
What legacy would you like to leave behind? Is there a problem out there that you'd like to be known as having solved?
Well, but two different issues. Legacy, I have a son. I want him to be a good man. That's the first legacy most of us should seek. I hope that when the work that I've done on how to structure organizations and how to be successful in when the world changes and you have to change too gets picked up and used widely. That would be what I would get professionally.
Dick, would you give us the web address for evidence-based research, please?
Sure. It's ebrinc.com. That's evidence-based research abbreviated.
Give it to us one more time. I don't want anybody to miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
www.ebrinc.
Fantastic.com. We've been speaking with Dr. Dick Hayes. Dick is the founder and president of evidence-based research. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Bob Fox, who is the founding principal of Fox Architects, and also the publisher of Workspace Design Magazine. In addition, Rich Guber. Rich is the CFO and executive vice president of Embrace Home Loans. Vicki Walker. Vicki is the chair of the Corporate Board Committee of Women in Technology and the leader of Leadership Foundry, and of course, most recently, Dr. Dick Hayes. Dick is the founder and president of Evidence-Based Research. I'd like to thank my co-hosts today, Phil Horeggi of Saber Systems and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney for helping me with the interviews. And more than anyone, I'd like to thank you, our listening audience. If it were not for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. So thank you very much. Don't forget to check us out at the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. We've been broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, so thank you to the folks at the Chamber. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I've been your host today. Thanks very much for listening. Until next time.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com
or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio.